Don't be afraid of the dark. Just relax and let the darkness fall over you.
Welcome to Afraidish, a podcast where we take a deep dive into the history and paranormal while enjoying some tasty adult beverages. From ghost sightings to hauntings, urban legends and cryptids, let's get weird and afraid-ish together. Welcome to episode 40. I'm Paul.
And I'm Ashley.
It has been a long time.
Yep.
Because since December, I've had a sinus infection, ear infection,
lower respiratory infection. And COVID
last week, yeah. So that's fun. And I've had a lingering cough since December, so...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't want to record and cough. We tried to record this a few weeks ago, but I was coughing through the whole damn thing.
Yeah, so. That was during your lower respiratory infection phase.
That sucked.
Lower respiratory era.
So, yeah, we're back.
Hopefully back.
For a while.
Yeah.
All right. What are we drinking?
Nothing.
Well, I'm drinking apple pie moonshine and Pepsi Zero again.
Yeah, and I was drinking 7-Up, but it's all gone.
Yeah. All right, let's get into it, because I have no idea how long this is going to be, because it's been forever since I looked at my notes. Here are five fun facts about wine.
Ooh.
Five fun facts.
Number one, the oldest known winery is believed to be the Arini 1 Winery, located in the village of Arini in Armenia. The winery dates back to around 4100 BCE and was discovered in 2007 by archaeologists.
Wow.
The site contains a wine press, fermentation vessels, jars, and cups, providing evidence of ancient winemaking practices. This discovery suggests that winemaking has a long history in the region, making the Arini 1 Winery one of the world's earliest known examples of winemaking.
Awesome.
That's pretty cool.
How many years ago did you say?
It's back to 4100 BCE.
4100 BCE, okay.
Yeah. Number two, specific vineyards adopt a method of farming known as biodynamic farming, which combines the principles of organic farming with an emphasis on the lunar and celestial cycles.
Ooh.
This approach aims to develop a holistic and sustainable ecosystem for the vineyard.
Nice.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Number three, grapes that freeze naturally on the vine are used to make ice wine. These grapes are picked and pressed while frozen, creating a sweet concentrated liquid.
Huh.
Yeah, I've never heard of that before.
Me neither.
Number four, the act of toasting originated in ancient Rome, where the Romans adopted the Greek tradition. The practice involved placing a piece of toasted bread into a glass of wine to improve the taste. The primary purpose of this practice was to soften any unpleasant or sour flavors.
It originated in Rome, that was adopted from the Greek tradition, meaning it originated in Greece?
Yeah, probably.
What?
This is from one of the facts that I read.
Right.
All right, yeah.
That's so funny.
I'm sure there's other articles that'll say something different.
Of course. So we know that the Romans were doing something that the Greeks did before them. Who knows who did it before the Greeks?
Yeah, who knows? All right, number five. If you're storing your wine bottles upright, switch it up. When stored upright, the cork can dry out and let air seep in, which can cause your wine to age too fast. Corks are made to be in constant contact with the wine, so it's better to store your bottles horizontally if possible.
Yeah, so I need a wine rack.
Yeah, I know. Bonus question. Can you name the Greek god of wine?
Dionysus.
Dionysus, yep. Now let's sit back, enjoy our wine, and learned some history about Belvoir Winery in Liberty, Missouri.
Dude, I really should have a glass of wine right now.
I know.
You should have told me that I should drink wine.
Sorry. So when I looked up how to pronounce the winery's name, which is spelled B-E-L-V-O-I-R, my search said it was pronounced Beaver. Beaver Castle, which is spelled B-E-L-V-O-I-R, in Leicestershire, is pronounced Beaver because the Anglo-Saxons couldn't pronounce the French name Belvoir.
That tracks.
Yep. Fucking Anglo-Saxons. The name comes from Norman times and means beautiful view in French. The Normans named the area Belvoir in French, but the Anglo-Saxons couldn't pronounce it, so they called it Beaver Castle, which this practice has continued for 1,000 years. Hmm. When I searched how to pronounce the winery in Liberty, Missouri, it said it is actually pronounced Belvoir, as it should be.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Or Belvoir.
So there's Beaver Castle, and there's Belvoir Winery.
That's so funny. Anglo-Saxons.
Yeah. Now let's learn about the Missouri International Order of the Odd Fellows.
Ooh.
Learning about the history and significance of the Odd Fellows home district in Missouri is fascinating. The district's Jacobean Revival structures, including one designed by William B. Itner, showcase the development of the Missouri Odd Fellows complex from 1900 to the present. It's also interesting to note that the fraternal organization provided care and education for the elderly, impoverished, and orphaned members of the turn of the century. At the turn of the century, the Odd Fellows home is an excellent example of a statewide home that catered to the needs of its members and provided a safe and caring environment for those who were less fortunate. Hmm. When it was built, there was only one other such home in the state, the Masonic home in St. Louis. One of the main reasons for the existence of the International Order of Odd Fellows and other fraternal societies was to provide care for its members, widows, and orphans.
So it's a Masonic affiliated organization. You have to be a Mason to be an Odd Fellow?
No.
No?
It's just another fraternal order like the Mason.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
The establishment of statewide homes such as the Missouri Odd Fellows in Liberty was viewed as a form of health and life insurance. As long as members were in good standing, they could count on the Odd Fellows to take care of them or their families if misfortune should arise.
Reminds me of the Pythian Castle.
Yeah.
Knights of Pythias.
Knights of Pythias. Exactly. Yep. This was therefore not looked upon as charity. To ensure against charity, residents at the home were expected to work on the 240-acre farm if physically able. This emerging concept of self-help was just developing in almshouses in Missouri during the later half of the 19th century.
Yay, almshouses. Yeah.
The almshouses tradition deferred from the then prevalent boarding out or leasing system of relief in which people experiencing poverty were sent to live with various families. The almshouse method was to buy or lease land and bring all people experiencing poverty under one roof. Unfortunately, the structure in which the inmates, which they were called, mm-hmm. were housed in Missouri at the time was often very crude. The Odd Fellows home was significant in that when it was built, it was a modern facility complete with heating, plumbing, and other conveniences.
Wow.
Fraternal organization homes differed from almshouses in other ways. Children and other people resided on the same site. For the most part, children were kept out of almshouses due to part of the fact that orphanages were well-established institutions by this time. The fraternal organization method of caring for their own less fortunate was significantly different from the care received by the general public in the 19th century, from its inception until the advent of the social programs of the 1930s, the Missouri Independent Order of Odd Fellows, or IOOF, home was associated with this up-to-date, benevolent method of caring for members of a fraternal society. The IOOF is one of the most significant fraternal and benevolent orders in the United States, with its chief purpose being to provide aid, assistance, and comfort to its members and their families. To become a member of the IOOF, individuals must be in continuous good standing in their lodge for 5 years before their submission for acceptance. The organization is a secret society with its own system of rights and passwords, just like any other secret society.
Yep.
The Odd Fellows Home was established to care for members who could not earn a livelihood due to age or affliction, those who were indigent, and the house or the wives and orphans of members. Members supported the home's cost by paying an assessment tax, and donations were always welcome. In 1883, the first petition to establish a state Odd Fellows Home was recorded, and Liberty, Missouri was finally selected as the home site in 1894. The Winter Hotel, built in Liberty in 1887, was sold to the Odd Fellows in 1895 and served as the home site. The Odd Fellows Home complex is an impressive example of Jacobean Revival architecture, consisting of several educational and institutional buildings. The three remaining historic buildings, the administration building, the old folks building, and the old hospital, were designed by different architects but share a cohesive design style.
Huh.
The complex was built after the original structure was destroyed in a fire. And the Grand Lodge of Missouri, IOOF, sought designs for a completely fireproof building to house offices, classrooms, dormitories, and rooms for older people.
How do you make a completely fireproof building?
Well, back then it was probably made with asbestos and not as much lumber, probably.
Okay. So stone facade, stone, brick, and yeah, lots of asbestos inside.
Probably, yep.
Cool beans. Mm-hmm. Okay.
The architects selected, including William B. Itner of St. Louis, went on to design many schools and other buildings across the country. The administration building designed by Itner set a precedent for the rest of the complex, and the other buildings reference this unique style. The old folks building was designed by E.C. Eckel, and the old hospital was designed by Samuel M. Hitt of Kansas City. These three remaining buildings document the evolution of this style over a quarter of a century and showcase typical building technology and materials for institutional structures. In the old folks' home building, located in the center of the property, the signs on the doors tell which individual lodge was the benefactor of the room and its inhabitant.
Oh.
The produce of the farm also supported the home. After purchasing all of the surrounding farmland, of which it had options, the board decided in 1900 to take control of all 247 acres of farmland at the home and cease renting out portions of the land.
Wow, that's a lot of land.
Yeah. The home could be self-supporting through farming. By 1905, the farm operation had grown so that a local farmer was hired to produce better results. Because the farm was essential to the home and for reasons stated earlier, many children and adults helped with daily chores.
Yeah.
Although the farm reports often needed to be completed, they give an excellent example of the size of the farming operations at the home. In 1901, it produced 838 bushels of oats, 2,000 bushels of corn, 500 bushels of Irish potatoes, 3 tons of hay, 7,863 gallons of milk, 1,714 pounds of butter, and 325 dozen eggs.
Damn.
That's crazy. Livestock included 3 horses, 52 cattle, 175 poultry, and 15 hogs. Nearly everything was kept for consumption at the home, but occasionally some sales brought in needed revenue.
Nice.
Which, yeah, if you have that much stuff, you're going to end up selling what you don't need.
Right. Don't let it go to waste.
Yeah. The typical residence profile changed over the home's history. In the early years, children far outnumbered adults. In 1912, 52 residents were adults and 111 were children. Most children were orphans and the average adult was in their 50s. By the late 20s, however, the proportion of adults increased dramatically. From 1932 to 1933, there were 236 adults and 98 children, the most significant number ever. Some people were down on their luck, undoubtedly due to the period's economics, and would stay until they could make it alone. A more significant number of non-orphan children were also admitted during this time, and their families were unable to care for them.
Hmm.
I think that's better than sending them to a mental facility back then, which they often did.
Yep.
The declining numbers at the home began after the advent of social programs for those less fortunate and older people in the 1930s. Newly developed local nursing homes were more attractive alternatives to older people, enabling them to remain near friends and family. By 1951, no children were at the home, and most applicants were permanent hospital patients.
Oh.
The history of home-based hospital care was recognized as a need as early as 1905. Due to the Grand Lodge's policy of not rejecting applicants with physical disabilities, many residents of the Oddfellows home required hospital care beyond what the staff nurse and doctors provided.
Hmm.
As a result, hospital facilities were eventually moved to the old folks' building, but it became clear by 1910 that a separate hospital building was necessary. Finally, in 1923, the old hospital was constructed on the property's northern end. At the time, it was the only medical facility in Liberty with its own laboratory.
Wow.
However, the hospital was soon deemed outdated as the hallways and doors were too narrow to accommodate bed patients and equipment.
Huh.
That's crazy.
Bad design.
Yeah. In 1955, the nursing home was built, and the Grand Lodge voted to allow non-members to be admitted to the hospital.
Oh, wow.
Probably as long as they paid.
Yeah.
Not only did the home provide a primary education, but it also encouraged the development of other skills and talents. For instance, in 1908, the home started offering instrumental music classes, which eventually led to the formation of a boys' band that toured the state annually.
Cute!
The education provided that at the home was often superior to what children might have received in their hometowns. And high school attendance was a matter of course, even though it was not a typical option for children at the turn of the century.
Yeah.
Because at that time, I think the kids just went to work on their farms instead of going to high school. Yeah.
I don't know that this is exactly correct, but I feel like the average education was like third grade, fourth grade.
I think it was like up to eighth grade.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then after that, it was like they needed to work on their family farm.
Yeah. Education was for wealthy folks.
Yeah, pretty much. By the 1920s, the home had even begun providing college tuition. However, as the number of children at the home decreased, the school building was eventually demolished. And by 1951, there were no longer any children at the home. The residents at the home were provided with more than just the necessities of life. In addition to food, shelter, medicine, and education for the children, the home attempted to enrich the residents' lives in other ways. Music and literary recitals by the children were performed for older people. Books and subscriptions to newspapers and magazines were always available. The boys even constructed crystal radio sets in the 1920s.
Neat.
Moving pictures were provided free of charge, and Sunday school meetings were conducted at the home, with transportation provided to the church service of choice in Liberty.
Of course.
Holidays were always celebrated, often completed with presents and refreshments provided by the home or from donations of lodges. A monthly dinner was held to celebrate any child having a birthday during that month.
Cute.
One of the society's primary purposes was to provide aid, assistance, and comfort to its members and families in times of need, including in case of sickness, misfortune, and even death. The Grand Lodge of Missouri offered an extensive benefit system, including cemetery plots, headstones, and burial services. For elderly residents, the Odd Fellows Home, who had no other arrangements, the cemetery on the northern end of the property was often used. In addition, current IOOF members could be buried at the Liberty Complex. Interestingly, the cemetery contains nearly 600 graves, and just outside the gate, there is a memorial dedicated by the Liberty IOOF Lodge to honor members who were killed in World War II. In 1993, Dr. John Bean and his wife, Marsha Bean, purchased the property, which is now under the ownership of their daughter, Melissa Limekuler. Limekuler.
I'm not even going to attempt.
Anyways, and the management of her husband, Jesse Limekuler. Jesse laughs as he recalls the state of the building, now the winery and inn, when Mr. and Mrs. Bean first purchased the property. Quote, "Before we bought it, it was used as a haunted house," he says.
Huh.
"So they had down the hallways like railroad tracks, you know, there was black paint everywhere, or there was black paint painted on the hallways and stuff hanging from the walls to make everything dark." So, yeah, it was just a fine, normal state. It was just in a fine, normal state.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Unquote, yeah. There's something about the land at Belleville Winery that causes all who visit it to experience a sense of stillness. It emotes a timeless eccentricity, yeah, that seems inexplicably untouched by the dizziness of modern preoccupations.
I thought you were going to say disease.
Yeah. Dizziness of modern preoccupations. Once inside, other timeliness touches every edge and corner, from the ceremonious stained glass windows and Tiffany light fixtures to the dignified portraits tucked among early 19th century Victorian-influenced couches and chaise lounges.
Cute.
The rooms are filled with relics from yesteryear, and the walls are lined with the history of the property and its previous custodians, the Odd Fellows. Jesse admits, surprisingly, that most of the rarities distributed throughout the winery were not intentionally left behind as decor. Quote, "The stuff that's on the walls in the hallway, that all came out of the restroom or time capsule in the cornerstone," he says. "The cornerstone was laid in 1900 as a part of a commencement ceremony when they finished the building. Then, I want to say it was like 2000 or something like that, the stone cracked. So right away we popped it open and pulled all this stuff out because we didn't want it to get molded now that it was exposed to heat and moisture. We pulled all this stuff out and hung it on the hallway, and then what's in the room, some of it I've purchased and some of it is donated," unquote. In addition to extending their enthusiastic approval of the winery and the survival of the history of the IOOF through the winery, the legacy holders of the fellowship have also made significant contributions to Belvoir. Quote, I was allowed by the Grand Master to go to the Grand Lodge and see if I could use anything here on site, Jesse says. The Oddfellows wanted stuff to be here because it helps them as a dying organization. They're being talked about literally every day because it's part of the experience here.
The Oddfellows still exist?
Yeah, oh, it does. Wow. Discussing the experience rendered by Belvoir Winery is only possible by mentioning George. George, whose favorite wine would be Casanova, if you're looking for recommendations, is the winery's beloved mainstay and natural attraction. His journey to Belvoir is intrinsically linked to the IOOF and is as spirited as the rest of the organization's history. Quote, he, George, was used as part of a ritual where they, like, basically lift their blindfolds and they present them as with a coffin and a body and say, you know, do what you can while you're alive because eventually this will be you, right? Says Jesse. So it's just a mortality check, basically, for them. Unquote. Uh-huh. That's right. George donated his remains to the fellowship he dearly loved in life. And Belvoir Winery is where he remains today.
Wait. What?
He was a member.
Real human body? Yes.
This happens. He was a member of the Oddfellows. And in his will, I guess, he donated his body to the Oddfellows.
But... Okay.
That's just what some people like to do.
All right.
It's not entirely sure who he was or his role in the operation of IOOF. George is a ubiquitous name given to all the skeletal remains at the Oddfellows' lodges. But his presence is thoroughly appreciated by visitors. People talk to him all the time, says Jesse. People bring him flowers and set them out there for him. It's also become a custom for brides to bring flowers to him on their wedding day for good luck.
Wow.
It's hard to not deny the intimate notion of camaraderie that becomes evident in the enduring commitment of George and his kin to the survival of the Oddfellows and their altruistic philosophy. Jesse expresses this same sentiment himself. Quote, a lot of people, you know, come for the wine or they come for the ghosts, he says. They don't know about the Oddfellows and what they were. They were a benevolent, very charitable order. The ritual was based on the parable of the Good Samaritan. All they did was just charitable work all the time. So it's good to keep their history alive.
Yeah.
Now for the hauntings. From a VinePair.com article called Happy Guests, Happy Ghosts, Inside Kansas City's Belvoir Winery and Inn from October 29th, 2023. So this is pretty recent.
Okay.
When you go through the gates and up the long driveway to Belvoir Winery and Inn, you'll first see an old brick building, an illuminated terrace, and a double door entryway. Turn to the left and you'll have a different view. Decaying structures over a century old. Just up the hill, a cemetery with nearly 600 time-worn headstones overlooks a block of grapevines. Ask almost anyone who visited, and they'll tell you the same thing. The whole place is full of ghosts. I was there at night. There was nobody else there, and I could hear a loud slam in the hallway, says Belvoir CEO Jesse Limekohler. I went out in the hall assuming someone was out there, but there was nobody. The weird part is that there was another slam on the third floor just a minute later, but the cameras didn't catch anything. The buildings that haven't been renovated used to be a hospital, an old folks' home, and a nursing home with a morgue in the basement. It's widely believed by both believers and paranormal and many skeptics who have visited and experienced unexplained things that many of those residents never left.
Yeah.
The tasting room, in particular, is the setting for a lot of activity. I had an event coordinator who was closing down for the night, Lehmkuhler explains. She had turned off the lights in one area, and when she went back into the tasting room, she saw the lights were back on. She went back to thinking that she had just forgotten to turn them off. Turned them off again, came back into the bar a second time, and looked back, and the lights were on again.
Creepy.
Yeah. But dealing with the spirits has become commonplace. She basically went into the room and said, "You know, I'm not sure who's here and not sure what you're doing, but I'm trying to close. You need to leave the lights alone." And she turned them off and went back, and the lights didn't go back on for the rest of the night, Lehmkuhler says.
Hmm.
That'd be pretty crazy.
Somebody just needed to be, have their presence acknowledged.
Yeah. The place that had such a reputation for being haunted that paranormal enthusiasts regularly travel there to investigate, and shows like Ghost Hunters and Kindred Spirits and Ghost Adventures have been filmed there. And The guest rooms upstairs, each named after one of the Belvoir's wines, there are guest books where people detail the unexplained things they've seen and heard. Even though it's really, really haunted, and yes, people do routinely leave in the middle of the night because they're terrified, I find it to be a very welcoming space, says Amy Bruni, paranormal researcher and co-host of Kindred Spirits. Bruni hosts an investigation weekend at the complex yearly with her paranormal travel company, Strange Escapes. She's experienced phenomena like pianos playing with no one near them, the sounds of moving furniture when nothing has been touched, and the whispers and giggles of kids in empty rooms.
I don't like that. I don't like kid stuff.
Yeah. Children's voices are most common in that building because that's where they live. It's really active in that area, she adds. Probably more so than any other areas on the property. Belvoir makes wines using primarily Missouri grapes. The state might not be top of mind regarding American wine production, but it has a rich viticultural history. The first AVA was designated in Missouri in 1980, but the story starts a lot earlier than when German immigrants started planting European grapes in the area. When Phylloxera decimated rootstock in France, Missouri was one of the first places to graft onto American plants and played a huge role in preserving those varieties.
Wow.
Just pretty wild. Pretty cool. Yeah. Among Belvoir's wines is its signature Norton, a dry, full-bodied red made with Missouri's official state grape of the same name, grown on the property. The medium-bodied Casanova blends Missouri Chamborson and St. Vincent grapes with California Syrah and a lighter red called Lucky Pierre, made with Concord, St. Vincent, and Chamborson. They also make three white blends and a rosé. And this year, they released a line of sparkling wines under their new Belvoir Three Graces label.
Champagne. Did you know, fun fact, you didn't have this in your fun facts, did you know that the difference between a red wine and a white wine
yes.
is not the color of the grapes?
I know.
It's whether or not the skins are left on during fermentation.
Yeah.
All That's red wines cool. have skins on, whether they're made with white or red or purple or black yeah. grapes.
Yep. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
If you were to go there and not know that it's haunted or didn't believe in ghosts, you might change your mind after a weekend, says Adam Berry, co-host of Kindred Spirits and author of Goodbye Hello, Processing Grief and Understanding Death Through the Paranormal. The buildings on the property were constructed from 1900 to 1935 and during the Great Depression. There were more child residents than adults, largely due to impoverished families surrendering their kids to the Oddfellows so that they would have better care and regular meals, which is very sad.
Yeah.
That the kids were well fed and cared for and were overall happy with the Oddfellows is one theory why the paranormal activity tends to be more playful and mischievous in the orphanage. The activity can be more aggressive or malicious in places where people, even kids, weren't treated as well, like the Ohio State Reformatory or the old Charleston Jail.
Yep.
The main things we have happen in the building are usually just fooling around or trying to get attention, Limecooler says. We've had tablets fly off the counter, doors open and close. We hear voices in the hallway by the tasting room, usually children's voices, that sound like a conversation. Then when you explore to figure out what's going on, there's nothing out there. However, one person who's always there is George, the human skeleton on display in the winery's room of Oddfellows artifacts. Each lodge had a skeleton, all named George, used in their secret initiation ceremony as a reminder that everyone dies and an imperative to treat people well during life. This one is the remains of a member who donated his skeleton to the order in the 1880s, which the winery acquired from a closing lodge. We thought if he can't stay there, at least he can be in a place where there's Oddfellows, Limecooler explains. We brought him back and he's become part of the family. We don't treat him like a skeleton, we treat him like a person. When there are weddings on the property, Limecooler says, it's become a good luck charm to give George flowers on your wedding day. When staff goes in to turn on or turn off the lights, they always say, hello, George, or have a good night, George. While the tasting room is in the orphanage building, the production facilities are in a building on the property that adults occupied. And Barry had encountered one there before and left an impression. There's a shadow figure that lurks behind the tanks, he says. I've seen them peeking out around there. Sometimes you're back there by yourself. You feel like you're being watched. You feel there's somebody back there surveying the area and what you are doing specifically. To see something peek around the corner or see a shadow move or hear footsteps, it just creeps you out. Limecooler characterizes the activity from adult spirits on the property as more serious, even though they're communicating that they want to be left alone. That's the nursing home area, he says, so we tend to have grumpy spirits there, for lack of a better description. I don't think they're malicious by any means, but I think they're just not really happy we're there. It's a different sort of vibe. That building isn't open to the public unless it's part of a paranormal investigation. But still, even if you do go poking around in the dark there, you're not likely to find anyone who's trying to scare you. It's a beautiful location that serves a purpose for the community, Barry says. It's a gathering place. Wine brings everybody together, and you know, you may get some unexpected spirits in the mix. So if you stayed in the Belvoir Winery, would it make you afraid-ish?
That depends.
Be a fun place to visit.
Yeah.
Do some wine tasting.
Yeah. You know I like wine.
Yeah. So, sorry if that was kind of messed up because I tried not to cough and all that. But I got through it.
Yeah.
So let's get out of here.
Okay.
So if you have any stories or requests of anything you want to hear about or know anyone who does, please email me at afraidishpodcast@gmail.com. Email me anything. Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at afraidishpodcast. Tell me what haunted location you want to hear about or any paranormal thing. All the links will be in the show notes. I have this on YouTube as audio. You can listen almost anywhere you listen to podcasts. Also rate and review on Apple Podcasts and rate on Spotify. 5 stars, please. You can now support this show with a small monthly donation to help sustain future episodes. This will help update recording equipment and other necessities for the podcast. Then when I get around to getting Patreon up and running, hopefully this year, you can support us that way.
Yep.
The link for that will be in the show notes. I am still working on a merch store. I've been working on some shirts that look pretty cool. And yeah. Just hook me up with some feedback of anything you want for the store. Until next time, don't be afraid of the dark. Be afraid-ish of what's in it. Bye.
Bye. It originated in Rome, that was adopted from the Greek tradition, meaning it originated in Greece.
Yeah, probably.